Council, let me, before, don't start the clock yet. Before you start, let me suggest to you, we have two cases involving the same parties. In one case, they're the appellant, in the other case, they're the appellee. You don't need to switch tables, right? You just stay right where you are when we get to the second case, all right? The other thing I want to tell you is that 30 minutes have been allotted for each case. However, you should not feel obliged to use it all unless it's necessary. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Mike Paterno, here representing Joseph Formal, Commissioner of the Revenue for Chesterfield County, and with me is co-counsel Jeffrey Minks, County Attorney for Chesterfield County. This case concerns whether or not Verizon set-top boxes it provides to cable subscribers are taxable locally. The case involves a question of statutory construction, which this case will use de novo. The statute in question is Virginia Code 581-1101A2A, which mandates that the machines used in the cable business be taxed locally as tangible personal property. This court has been steadfast in adhering to its principles on statutory construction. Those legal principles have been well established just as recently as about 6 weeks ago in the Miller and Rhodes case. Even though this court split 4-3 on the substance of the case, you were all in agreement on the paramount principle of statutory construction, which is that the court must interpret the statute as written. In other words, the question is not what the General Assembly intended to enact, but rather what is the meaning of that which the General Assembly did enact. We presume the General Assembly says what it means and means what it says. Therefore, we apply the plain meaning of the words unless the words are ambiguous.
Is the word machines ambiguous as applied to this fact pattern?
No.
Well, the Commissioner of the Revenue disagrees with the State Tax Commissioner, and the Circuit Court of Chesterfield disagrees with itself. Aren't they all reasonable interpreters of the same word?
No, Your Honor. I think the conclusion that machines is ambiguous, that conclusion has been reached by violating another rule of statutory construction that this court has laid down, which is that it's impermissible to look to extrinsic evidence to create ambiguity where none otherwise exists. And I believe in all those instances, whether either a court or the tax commissioner has concluded that machines is ambiguous, has violated this court's rule on statutory construction in that regard.
Counsel, one fascinating aspect of this, I think that your the way that you have posited the statutory construction rubric in your brief is well done, and we look to the plain meaning first. And there is a question about whether machines is ambiguous or is not, and the way that you parsed the Webster's definition I thought was particularly impressive.
Thank you.
There's nonetheless a hurdle that I think you have to cross before we even look to outside of the statute itself. And here it is. In the Eberhardt case several years ago, this court pointed out that the Code of Virginia is, in fact, not the best description of what the law is, that the acts of assembly actually rise higher than the code. That is the pure law of Virginia. And in Exhibit 17, page 773 of the Joint Appendix, is in fact that 1984 Act of Assembly, which then created the section of the Code of Virginia that we are that's being litigated here. And interestingly, in the Act of Assembly, you can see where the words tuners and converters was eliminated from the prior statute, raising the question or leading potentially to the conclusion that the General Assembly was telling localities you can't tax tuners and converters. And either fortunately or unfortunately, we don't have to get into the issue of what part of statutory construction, you know, can we look to the underlying intent, et cetera? Can we look to legislative history? Can we look to a fiscal impact statement? Because that, in fact, is the law of Virginia. That strike-through is, in fact, the law of Virginia. So I think that has to be addressed first before we even reach fiscal impact statements or things of that nature. It appears that the General Assembly was saying localities can't tax tuners and converters.
Justice Mims, I think I would agree with you if that was the only thing that happened here, but that's not what happened. Converters and tuners was removed at the same time that machines was added. When the cable industry was taken out of Section A2 and it was given its separate section of A2A, the term machines was added, which did not previously exist under the prior version of the statute. So converters did come out, I concede that, but a new category of property, machines, was added, which under its plain meaning at the time and long before that and today included electronic devices such as a set-top box.
And your argument is, therefore, machines is not ambiguous as it was added at that time.
Exactly.
Well, I will say this. When they remove tuners and converters and add machines, they certainly had two terms that I think everyone would agree had no possible ambiguity, and added a term that various people seem to think does have ambiguity. So, those members of the General Assembly from 1984 who are still around perhaps need to be called in front of the bar of the court.
Now. That's why you've laid down some very good rules on statutory construction, so we don't do that. And that really is the heart of Verizon's argument, obviously, is that that converters came out and that meant something. But they're ignoring the other part of the legislation, which was that machines was added, and that really is the thrust of our argument as well. And what Verizon has cited in their briefs ignores the fact that a key piece of the legislation was the added category of machines, which under its plain meaning clearly included set-top boxes, which Verizon concedes. We entered into stipulations in this case on the definition, as the court has pointed out, and we looked at what the sense of the word machines is. And this court has said that a word is ambiguous if it has no sense or it has a double sense in which you can't apply both definitions and make the statute make sense, make it be operable, or it leads to internal inconsistencies. And in this case, the parties agreed that when you look at the sense of the word machines, there are clearly senses of that word that don't apply, such as when we refer to a political machine or a governmental machine. And what's left is really the only sense of the word that could possibly apply, which is a sense of the word that refers to property, whether it be mechanical, whether it be electrical, whether it be electronic. It includes all those things, and that makes perfect sense in a statute that applies to the property used in a cable business. But notwithstanding those stipulations, the trial court seemed to look past that, found the statute clear as mud, and looked at the extrinsic evidence, which this court said should not be done. Verizon's argument also is, even if we were to look at those definitions, ambiguity is created by the fact that you have entries in the dictionary that say a machine is essentially a mechanical device. Then you have entries in the dictionary that say it's a mechanical, electrical, or electronic device. And according to Verizon, that is textbook ambiguity. You've got two entries in the dictionary. Respectfully, I think if you looked up just about every word used in the Code of Virginia, you would find multiple entries in the dictionary. And that cannot be, and is not, a test for ambiguity.
Can I ask you this? If we clear the ambiguity hurdle and decide it is ambiguous, do you lose? Or are all your chips on the it's not ambiguous, and therefore that's why you win?
No, Your Honor. I think if for some reason you find the word machines ambiguous and you then start looking at extrinsic evidence, such as the so-called legislative history of the statute, you clearly have the obvious fact that converters came out, machines came in. But I don't think you can draw any other conclusion except that converters are still taxable, notwithstanding that the word came out, because the word machines came in and is in a broader sense of the word. Even the tax bulletins and various legislative impact statements that were issued by the tax commissioner back at that time indicated that the significance of the legislative change was that a new category of machines is now taxable locally and is the actual machines used in a cable business. And they clearly are the actual machines used in a cable business.
And there's a follow-on question to that. If, for example, we part the file of this legislation and we find a report by the Senate Finance Committee staff that's clearly acceptable legislative history, which would be given whatever weight each justice determines that it ought to be given. But what about a fiscal impact statement filed by an executive agency after the legislation was introduced before it was adopted, the FIS that we find in this very file? Is that acceptable legislative history? Why or why not?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that it is. If you go to some of the documents that...
Do you have any state or federal case to that effect? I view that as a fascinating secondary issue here. Is to what extent are various things that are in the file actually acceptable legislative history?
I think if you decide the word is ambiguous and you need to look to extrinsic evidence, I'm not sure that it's clearly defined as to where you can stop where you stop. I mean, I think you look to anything you can put your hands on, perhaps, that helps you. But I think the Brown versus Lucard case is very similar. In that case, that was when the court had to determine whether there had been a defunding of the AIDS-dependent children program. And the State Board of Welfare adopted a policy based on a legislative impact statement, which was basically a fiscal impact statement, which said the purpose of this act is to defund that part of the program for 18 to 20-year-olds who are attending school. And it really came down to the fiscal impact. In the trial court kind of found the budgetary process to be complex. That was the extent of its finding of ambiguity. This is a complex process. And then looked to the fiscal impact of the bill that it concluded from a legislative impact statement that even though the program had been funded, the funding was not intended to fund that piece of the program, which applied only to young people 18 to 20 years old. This court said, no, you can't do that. We have an unambiguous statute, including the Appropriations Act, and you can't look to the extrinsic evidence to create ambiguity where none otherwise exists.
Thank you.
Here we're dealing with a taxing statute, and there's a powerful strain of construction canons that say if there's any way to read this favorable to the taxpayer that's still reasonable, you should. And that's not exactly the clean cut between ambiguous and unambiguous that we normally use in statutory construction, but given the reasonable disagreement as to this very word by the most knowledgeable people in the state applying it, excluding us as of yet, isn't it something that we should rely upon, the thumb on the scale that says, look, if you're going to enter into a complex or a difficult area of law, you've got to make it clear when you're dealing with a tax statute?
It's true that any doubt should go to the taxpayer, but that does not mean that the court is supposed to read words with a plain meaning to say something that they don't say.
Right, but going back to your first example, the Millen Roads case, I mean, obviously we all agree the plain meaning is the rule, but the devil's in the details.
Understood. I guess I'll reserve the balance of my time, which is not much. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. My name is David Obelon from Albo and Obelon. I'd like to introduce to you Eric Tresh, my colleague from Sutherland, who is admitted before this Court for AugVJ. At the counsel table is Maria Viava, who is counsel for Verizon, also admitted for AugVJ.
Where are you admitted?
Your Honor, I'm admitted in Atlanta, Georgia, and New York.
Welcome to Purdue.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the members of this Court for allowing me to appear here today. May it please the Court, Your Honors. As Mr. Obelon said, my name is Eric Tresh, and I represent Verizon Online in this case. Your Honors, I think Commissioner Horrible misstates or unduly narrows this Court's test for ambiguity, and that's sort of the first fault in the argument. What this Court said recently in Blake and has said time and time again in the ambiguity cases is the definition for ambiguity is not limited to the hierarchical senses of the dictionary. That's not, while I agree, a very clever argument, it's not the be-all, end-all. What this Court has said is that the text of a statute, and not just one word, but the entire text, can be understood in more than one way or refers to two or more things simultaneously. You've got an ambiguous statute. We're not limited to those hierarchical senses in the dictionary. When this Court has used the term sense, which originated back in the Ayers case in 1939, I think was the first use of sense in the context of ambiguity, the Court has various times used the term sense as a synonym for meaning. Sense and meaning kind of refer to one another back and forth. And in this case, there's a stipulation by the parties that says not to what the senses of the words are, but there's a stipulation by the parties in this case that says that machines are capable of two definitions, that's the word that's used in the stipulation between the party, that apply in the context of the statute. One of those definitions applies to cable converters. Another one of those definitions does not apply to cable converters. That's the textbook definition of ambiguity in Blake. We also never limited the analysis to those definitions in Webster's. As a matter of fact, what the stipulations say is there are multiple definitions of machines that could apply, and then it just cites the two definitions, again using that word definitions that Mr. Hobel talked about, as examples of machines that could and could not apply. Now, that's just one of the reasons why the statute is ambiguous. The second thing we have to look to is what we've got at issue here is not just a word. Again, this Court has said time and time again, I look at the entire statute as enacted in the Code of Virginia. And what we've got here is an exclusion from property tax for all cable property. That's the first part of the statute. So the intent of the legislature was to exclude cable property from tax. And then I've got a carve-out for certain items. Now, among those items are the phrase machines and tools. Nobody in this case has offered up a meaning, what a plain meaning for that phrase, machines and tools, would be in the context of a statute that excludes all cable television property from local property tax. Now, going back to the legislative history of this matter, Commissioner Horrible had pointed out that there was a secondary change. At the time the statute was amended in 1984, we had the strike through. The legislature specifically deleted converters from the statute. And Commissioner Horrible said they added this term machines. Well, that's partially right, but what they did was, and you can see this in the strike through, they changed machinery and tools, which was in the former version of the statute, to machines and tools. And so they did two things. So they strike through converters, which had existed alongside machinery and tools in the prior version of the statute. And then they went ahead and changed the law to eliminate converters. What was meant by that new phrase, machines and tools, was it meant to subsume those items which they had just struck through? There's no evidence of that. And and if you were to try and determine whether they had a plain meaning, if you accept Commissioner Horrible's approach for ambiguity, what he's saying is that with any one sense in Webster's, I should use all of the definitions that they give to define the term. That would be machines. If I were to use those senses that apply in the context of the statute, particularly the two examples that were given, the exception would swallow the rule. The definitions that Commissioner Horrible proposes are so broad and so encompassing that they would apply to almost everything that a cable television company does. And there were other exceptions after the term machines and tools. So you've got this exception from the general rule for machines and tools. But then the statute goes on to include antenna, studio equipment, cables. All of those additional terms would be subsumed within Commissioner Horrible's dual definitions of machines and tools by limiting the test for ambiguity to mutually exclusive senses. This court has never said that.
So those words would be rendered superfluous. I mean, for example, a motor vehicle is a machine by any broad definition. So why do we have motor vehicles or studio equipment if they're machines to begin with?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. The broad definition renders the word superfluous. Now, turning to the question of whether or not if the word is ambiguous, or what's the next part of the court's analysis? So we've got this ambiguous statute. Well, we have to determine whether converters are then taxable in the first place. And then we get into this extrinsic evidence. And I would agree with Commissioner Horrible that when you get into extrinsic evidence, as he just said, you really are free to look at whatever type of evidence is presented before the court as part of the legislative history. There hasn't been a limitation. As a matter of fact, in the Brown case that Commissioner Horrible just cited, the reason they excluded that legislative impact statement was because they found that statute unambiguous. That was the whole issue in the case. Otherwise, the court would have considered it. Now, in this case, what Commissioner Horrible is really asking you to do is, in determining the intent of the legislature, which really is the inquiry before us today, to determine the intent of the legislature, let's look at what actually happened. So the first thing that happened was, at the time the bill was being proposed, you had the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Commissioner Morrison, and there is a letter in the file to Chairman Morrison, and that letter was a legal opinion that he requested as to the definition, is machines more broad or more narrow than machinery? He was changing the statute, eliminating converters. The legal opinion Commissioner Morrison got, which was in the legislative file, said that machines was a more narrow term than machinery. So if converters had sat beside machinery in the old version of the statute, Chairman Morrison was being told that machines was more narrow, that would lead one to believe that we weren't trying to include converters in that term, we were actually excluding them. The next piece of extrinsic evidence is a letter from the Virginia Tax Commissioner while the bill was being proposed to Commissioner Morrison, and that letter says in no uncertain terms, the impact of the bill you were proposing would be to eliminate converters from tax, and there was a fiscal impact statement attached to that memorandum, and the fiscal impact statement indicated that there would be a fiscal impact, would cost money to remove converters from tax. After that, there was a second fiscal impact statement that was issued by the commissioner after the bill was engrossed. That says converters are exempt. Following those two fiscal impact statements, the bill is enacted.
Can I ask you this? I don't mean to sidetrack you, but these converter boxes are everywhere. How many localities are currently taxing them? I'm just trying to figure out what impact this might have either way.
So for almost 30 years, the evidence in this case showed that almost no localities had taxed converter boxes. There are two court cases pending in Henrico County and in Virginia Beach. And they have made an attempt to tax converter boxes, but in terms of whether the longtime cable companies, Comcast, Cox, those folks have been paying around Virginia, they hadn't been. And that goes to another reason.
This is sort of a novel, because this amendment has been around for a while. It doesn't change the legal answer, but it's nice to know what impact this might have on localities and on companies.
Really very little, because that's been the law. In going through the kind of history of this, the tax commissioner has said, since the bill was enacted back in 1985, he issued a tax bulletin that said converters aren't subject to tax. In 1987, the Arlington Circuit Court ruled definitively that converters, in a final order, are not subject to tax. So for 30 years, nobody thought converters were subject to tax. Now, Commissioner Horrible made the statement in his brief, well, when he looked at it, he came into office for the first time in, I think, 2004. And he looked at converters and he said, now, this word has got a plain meaning. That's not quite right. If you look at the file in this case, going to the impact this would have, in 2006, Commissioner Horrible, not his predecessor, Commissioner Michael, but Commissioner Horrible's office issued a letter to Comcast Corporation saying converters are not subject to tax. So we think about divergent interpretations. That's one of the tests for ambiguity. Not to go back to that, but divergent interpretations would be one. Not only have three circuit courts said that the statute is ambiguous and converters are not taxable, the Commissioner of Virginia Taxation has said that converters are not taxable. Commissioner Horrible himself wrote a letter to Comcast in 2006 saying converters are not taxable. And so now to come to this court and say not only are they taxable, but that the word is perfectly clear, seems to stretch the bounds of what a lot of very reasonable people have viewed the statute as, how Commissioner Horrible's own people have viewed the statute, and really goes to violating that cardinal rule of statutory construction that you pointed out, Your Honor, which is that tax statutes are to be construed narrowly against the government and in favor of the taxpayer. Now, in this case, Commissioner Horrible has admitted that there are two definitions of a machine at least. We just listed those as examples, some of which would apply to converters, some of which would not. And using that concept of statutory construction, we must conclude that the converter boxes are not subject to tax. Very quickly on plain meaning, Your Honor, if you were to determine that the statute was capable of a plain meaning, the converters still aren't subject to tax for three very quick reasons. One is because of that cardinal rule of statutory construction. We would urge that this court should accept the plain meaning of the term, the definition of the term that Commissioner Horrible said in his stipulation does not apply to cable converters. Two, in a plain meaning analysis, if you go to the Acts of Virginia that were actually enacted and you see the strike-through of converters, you can see that converters and tools sat alongside machinery and tools. And when the legislature eliminated the term converter and enacted that more narrow definition of a machine, you can see very well that the intent just on the face of that statute was to exclude converters from tax.
Can I ask you this question? So is it possible conceptually to say that given that unique strikeout phenomena in the Acts of Assembly, that the word machines in this statute as applied to cable companies and in particular as applied to converters is ambiguous to that extent? Without having to say the word is just hopelessly ambiguous and we got to try extrinsic evidence in every single car case.
100%, Your Honor. Numerous precedents from this court say you evaluate the terms of the statute in its context. And in the context of a statute that excludes cable television business, cable property used in a cable television business from tax, and then has all these other terms, in that context, machines and tools is ambiguous. That phrase. Whether machines is ambiguous in any other context, this would have no bearing on that, in our view. With that, Your Honors, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the Circuit Court and award Verizon a refund. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. You have 34 seconds left in this round, if you deemed it necessary to use it.
It's only 30 seconds. Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I don't think it's reasonable to interpret that the word machines as excluding converters, notwithstanding the word came out.
Counsel, what about the fact that it was machinery and tools with converter and changed to machines and tools and took converter out? Doesn't that, at a minimum, make it ambiguous?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so because, see, I'm out of town, but if I can answer the question. Machinery and tools, as used in A2, had been associated with manufacturing and other industrial uses, as this court had determined. And cable was plunked down in that section, but equipment, including converters and tuners, are not used in an industrial sense or manufacturing in any sense, so they were listed separately. When cable industry got its own section under 2A, it was perfectly reasonable to use the term machines. And when converters came about, instead of machinery and tools, they're similar words, and this court has said machinery and tools is not ambiguous. But machines is more applicable to the property and the industry. Yes, Your Honor.
Has he satisfactorily answered your question?
He has, thank you.
All right, your time has expired. The clerk will call the next case.